position number 11718.
Real
2.
Mr. Glashofer for real 2.
Yes, as I was saying, only once I remember that perhaps should explain that this was in 41 September, beginning of our last year in secondary school. We were 17. I was a member of a sports club and was often away at sports meetings. And once I came back, and four of our colleagues were gone. And they had been arrested by the Gestapo for distributing leaflets made from BBC broadcasts, which was forbidden to be listened to. They were accused of high treason. Two of them sentenced to death, and the other two in terms of imprisonment. Although 9 months later, the death sentence was commuted to imprisonment, and they spent the rest of the war in the in prison. But one of them, the ringleader, whose name was Landgraf, one of the teachers after the arrest once said in class, "Oh, poor Landgraf, I feel so sorry for him." And that's all anyone ever said about that. We sometimes made jokes, which we were cautioned against. I remember once saying in class, when the subject came up of the book by Hitler, Mein Kampf, I sort of jokingly said Mein Krampf, which is a play on words in German, which means instead of my struggle, my cramp. And the teacher overheard that, cautioned me not to say things like that, but there were still jokes made, political jokes, during the war in various ways.
Can you recollect any?
Well, I mean, there are the famous ones, like, for instance, the Hermann Göring once said as head of the Luftwaffe that if an enemy bomber ever penetrated over Berlin, his name would be Meyer. And then after that, of course, when the first bombers had come, he was known by many people as Hermann Meyer. And various other political jokes like that. Or somebody would say, instead of the Tausendjährige Reich, which means the Thousand-Year Reich, the Dutzendjährige Reich, which means the Thousand-Year Reich, which is a rather play on words. Actually, as it turns out, it's really prophetic, because it did last almost exactly 1,000 years, 33 to 45. So, there were other jokes. I don't remember at the moment.
Do you remember any wisecrack which was made when Hess made his famous flight to Scotland?
No, I don't. I mean, we heard about it, and of course, we only heard the official explanation. We didn't know anything else about it, and we always thought. We didn't think all that much about it, because Hess had always been a rather wild-eyed individual, and he looked to us as if he had been off his rocker anyway. So this flat of Hess, the official explanation, seemed to fit pretty well, that he had nervous breakdown or whatever.
You were speaking earlier about Hitler himself. But how were the other individuals in the National Socialist hierarchy regarded? Goebbels and Himmler and so on?
Well, Himmler, of course, was not a popular figure. I mean, he was his appearance and his... although he... One didn't hear all that much about Hitler Himmler anyway. Goering was mostly a figure of fun to almost everybody because of his obesity and also his flamboyant uniforms. He was rather regarded as a clown, almost by everybody.
But was he respected for his First World War flag?
For his First World War, but nothing since then. And others were... I remember that there was the youth leader, Baldur von Schirach, who was has a reputation of being a homosexual, as were others as well. And some of them were very unappetizing figures too, like Streicher and some of the Funk. And not at all the Aryan type that, that you would expect to be higher up. And some of them were rather feared figures, like Heydrich. I thought everybody was sort of felt that he would be capable of anything.
And Goebbels?
Goebbels was regarded as a very clever chap, although not prepossessing in his appearance, but he was a good speaker, and he spoke fairly good German too. And his speeches were a lot better than Hitler's.
Did he speak with a Rhinelander accent?
No, no particular accent. I think he has his own sort of speech peculiarities, but it was a rather average, nondescript, I thought. No particular accent.
Was he believed?
I mean, he wasn't strong on facts. I mean, he was mainly a propagandist. And I think most people were aware that most of the things that were said over the radio and in the newspapers was propaganda. I think probably, as far as that goes, propaganda, politically propaganda, we were less credulous then. Than people are nowadays about politicians. I think we didn't believe or trust them nearly as much as modern politicians still are. Much more skeptically.
Did you see anything personally about the fate of the Jews in Vienna?
Not personally, no. One saw, of course, slogans on walls, And I only knew one Jewish family who had lived in the same block of flats as we had much early on, much before the Anschluss. And we didn't see anything of them since after the Anschluss. And I really didn't know. A school friend of mine, after I had left the seminary and went to another school in Vienna. By the time I got there, it was in September 38, a few months after the Anschluss. Apparently, all the Jewish pupils had been transferred somewhere else to another school. So I didn't know any of them. When I was in school, there was only one half-Jew in the class, and I'm told that there was another one that I never thought was half-Jewish, who joined. Actually, half-Jews were accepted, and I didn't know that because, after the war, I met several who had been in the armed forces. And this one school colleague of mine, who was apparently a half-Jew, had even become an officer. And another one certainly survived the war without any trouble, other than being a member of the armed forces.
What did you feel about what was happening to the Jews?
Well, we didn't really know all that much about it. We knew they were being resettled, and one certainly didn't see much of them. Occasionally, one might come across someone with a yellow star on the clothes, but there wasn't all that much evident. And we knew about Dachau, which was a sort of concentration camp, but that was one of the earliest ones. It was even there before the Anschluss, I think. And it was known as a camp, a work camp, for all sorts of people, not only Jews, but communists and homosexuals, gypsies, and other, people who didn't fit in.
Did you have any conception of what was happening inside places like Dachau?
Well, of course, we knew that it wasn't easy, but we had no idea that it was. And I think Dachau probably wasn't really an extermination camp. And as far as the other extermination camps, we knew absolutely nothing.
You mentioned the chaps who'd cycle-style the BBC material. Did you yourself listen to foreign broadcasts?
No, I didn't ever. As I say, we had this government supplied radio, which didn't receive anything except local broadcasts, and we had no way of getting any foreign papers or anything like that.
Did you at any stage think that the Germans were going to win the war?
No. I knew they were lost when they turned against the Russians. But I never thought... Well, before then, I thought perhaps, the war would end with some sort of peace treaty.
Some compromise.
Some compromise, perhaps. But I could never see them win against the rest of the world, no.
Did you have to join the Hitler Youth?
Yes. I didn't at first because I didn't like the regimentation, but as I say, I was in this sports club, which was called the Vienna Cricket and Football Club, just like that. Although we never played cricket or football, it was an athletic club, running, jumping, throwing, and that sort of thing. And that was then taken into the Hitler Youth. So all that happened really was that we had a bit of a badge on our training suits that it was still called the Vienna Cricket and Football Club, or cricket on the front of the.
When did it become part of the Hitler Youth?
Well, I don't remember. It must have been in the middle of the war, probably 41, sometimes 40, 41.
Did it make any difference to you or to the club that it was absorbed?
Yes, it did. Personally, it did, because there was a chap a year ahead of me in school who was a dunce. In fact, I had given him... tutored him. What do you say? Helped him with his schoolwork because he was not a very good pupil, and he was a year older. And he was he was one of the first to join, and became one of the Hitler Youth leaders. And after I had been taken into the Hitler Youth, I had to attend their meetings. And they delighted in taking us on marches and drilling us, and as it was called, then Schleifen, which means to make people throw themselves down in the mud and crawl in the mud and up the trees and all that. So the thing, and I resented having this done to me by someone I had been helping with his schoolwork. So I didn't like this sort of drilling anyway. But being treated like that by some dunce wasn't very pleasant, no.
Now, I think that in 1942 you had to do work service. Can you tell me about
it? Well, the work, there was always an organization called the Arbeitsdienst, and that was from before the war. It was a scheme, an organization, which required every German man, boy or girl, to do 9 months service for the country. They had a special uniform, a brown uniform, and their emblem was the spade. And you were supposed to train for work, manual work, and you. But it was a very sort of military organization with drill and everything, except for instead of the gun, the rifle, they carried the shoulder and presented the spade, and that was supposed to be a peacetime thing. Because when after the war started, it became rather paramilitary. We still had the spade, but we also were trained on rifles and military drill. And during the war, we were, of course, in peacetime, we were supposed to be building roads and all sorts of construction. But after the war started, of course, then it became a pre-military training. And then in my case, after the invasion of Russia, we were sent to occupied Russia for manual labor. And we were in the southern Ukraine, stationed there for, I think it was 6 months.
What was the name of the place?
It was called Kramatorsk, or Kramatorskaya, in the Ukraine, not far from, it was. Taganrog was one of the nearest places. I forget the names now, but anyway, it was a good sized town, a very industrial with steelworks and all that. And the thing was, there was an airfield there from which the bombers flew to bomb Stalingrad, because it was only about 200 miles west of Stalingrad. And we worked in the steel mills, and we worked on the airfields and digging ditches and loading bombs and all that sort of thing. And we stayed there until December 43. And at that time, that was before Stalingrad fell, a lot of the units were immediately transferred from the labor service into the army and kept, and then sent to the front. But luckily our unit was sent back home, and we had a couple of weeks leave and then were drafted into the army.
What was the supervision of the work like?
It was its own command structure. It was like an army unit. We had they had different names. They weren't called lieutenant. They were called Arbeitsführer and Oberarbeitsführer and so on up to the higher grades. And it was a very, very strict. It was a very rough and strict discipline, far worse than the army. And the And the leaders of the service were all tended to be rather sadistic.
Did you suffer from that
personally? Oh, yes. Oh, I, in fact, if I had known how bad it was, I would have volunteered to join the army, because if you did, you got out of that. And a number of my school colleagues volunteered, of my best friend volunteered for the paratroopers, others for some other special service, but I didn't volunteer, so I was drafted into that, but it was miserable. The food was very short. Down in the Ukraine, the sanitary conditions were terrible. We had all sorts of epidemics, typhoid, of which several died, and even an outbreak of infectious appendicitis, and I never knew there was such a thing, but there is such a thing as infectious appendicitis, and yellow jaundice, and all sorts of things. So because the water was not very drinkable, and in the southern Ukraine in the summer it gets very, very hot, and then it turns suddenly, almost overnight, from very hot to very cold, and we weren't prepared for it. Of course, we suffered from frostbite and all that after that, after the weather turned.
What sicknesses did you pick up?
I didn't. I was very lucky. I didn't, actually. I don't know why. I did sham once to get out of the work. And there was an infirmary, and there were sort of straw mattresses in an old abandoned schoolhouse, and everybody was lying around there. And I was on one of those pallets. And in order to keep up the appearance, I rubbed the thermometer to cause it to rise with friction, you see. To see that I had a temperature. He said, I was running a temperature, although I didn't. And I was discovered doing that, of course. I was immediately thrown out, and I spent, I think it was either 1 week or 2 weeks in a cell, as a punishment, with bread and water. Although, actually, the normal fare wasn't much better than that, but it was just bread and water for a week in a darkened cell with shuttered window.
What was your attitude towards the regime by now?
Well, it wasn't the regime, it was the conditions. I mean, you were hungry, you were filthy. You had to work hard. You were humiliated all the time. You hated every minute of it. And I think the 9 months I spent in the labor service were the longest 9 months I've ever spent in my life, because it just seemed endless. Every day was an eternity.
Was it just Germans and Austrians who were working on your particular work
part? Yes, it was. Yes, Germans, Austrians, mixed. They never went in for all Austrian units, either in the labor service nor in the army, because they didn't quite trust the Austrians by themselves. They always mixed in Germans with us.
Do you think that their lack of trust was well-founded?
Yes, I think so. If for no other reason than that the Austrians tend to be rather unmilitary. And if you had them all together in one bunch, it would sort of, their discipline probably would have deteriorated. But with the stiffening of the Germans, it was that was the idea, stiffen them up a bit.
Did it work?
Well, to some extent. So I mean, it wasn't the first time they did that. In fact, in the First World War, on the Italian front, when the Austrians couldn't make any headway against the Italians, they sent in German units. Rommel was there in the First World War. And once the Germans came in, the Italians retreated, you see. There was some reason for that.
Did you have anything to do with the local Ukrainians?
Very little. Personally, I hardly saw any. In fact, although it was a sizable town and all that, the only people that were left were old men and women and a few children.
What was their attitude toward you?
Well, I didn't speak any Russian except the old word here and there. But they suffered a great deal. I mean, they were really starving. And the only thing I saw, there was one place where they processed sunflower seeds into cooking oil. And because the Russians were always chewing sunflower seeds, it was their chewing gum nourishment. And we saw very few Russians or Ukrainians as they were then. Most of them had been evacuated.
Did you get any impression of the state of the country under the Soviet system?
No, none at all. Except that we were quartered Kramatorskaya was in two parts. There was an old town and a new town. The new town was the large steelworks and some other works, and new apartment blocks, these harrahs, not all harrahs, but several stories high. And there was a tram line connecting the old town and the new town. And the new apartment buildings were rather impressive. They were fairly well built, and it was against the Russian winter, you know, triple glazed and all that, and even had a provision for central heating in them, although it wasn't working at the time. So I thought that the workers' quarters were quite decent. Because we spent some time in them being quarantined due to an outbreak of typhoid. We were quarantined for a couple of weeks and had extra rations. I think it was a pint of milk a day. And after about 2 weeks of it, we started getting chubby because we had been so short on food. You know, we used to take the unwrapped maize from the fields and roast them on an old shovel over a fire, you see, until they turned black and popped, you know, like sort of popcorn, and at that, you know, and moldy pieces of bread, if we could find them, we had anything. Because the ration was... the rations were very short. It was, I mean, the standard ration of in the labor service and in the army was 1/3 of a loaf of kommis bread, which is a rough blackish bread. One loaf to three people, a tiny pat of margarine, and a little piece of sausage. And a dab of sort of artificial marmalade. That was the day's ration. And from that, where you were supposed, and from that, you had to have your breakfast and your evening meal out of it, and part of the bread for your midday meal. And the only thing you got was a